You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Marc Maron has performed as a stand-up comedian for decades. In 2009, he started the podcast WTF, the initials of a phrase that we can't say on the air. On it, Marc revealed his talent for addressing topics that most of us would have a hard time finding funny: depression, anxiety, jealousy, addiction, and anger. He's produced over 500 episodes, including interviews with Louis C.K., Sarah Silverman, Janine Garofalo, Mel Brooks, and Robin Williams. It's been downloaded over 1 million times a week, more than 140 million times in all. And he's about to start production on the third season of his IFC television show, Maron, which is loosely based on his life. I'm very pleased that all of those things have brought Marc Maron to our show today. Hello.
Nice to see you, Leonard.
How old were you when you first started performing stand-up?
I think I was like 20, maybe, 1987-ish.
Had you been the class clown?
Sure, I was a problem. I think that's, I don't know if I would have been considered that. I was a class clown, but I was more of a problem for teachers, and I had no discipline, really, and if I got bored, I would make problems. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Which is shouting out something you thought was funny.
Yeah, usurping the power of who's in charge. Whoever that. I once, a Hebrew school teacher, I made cry. That was a very proud moment. Made a Hebrew school teacher cry. And then an algebra teacher actually slapped me in the face. I don't know if that would have been stood for at this juncture in history, but at the time, I think I had it coming.
So when you started thinking of doing stand-up, that's a big break from just acting out. What kind of routines did you do? If you look back to them now, would you be totally embarrassed?
No, it's odd. I'm less embarrassed than I thought I would be. I think I started experimenting with stand-up in college. I'd always wanted to do it. Comics always brought me a great deal of joy, and they seemed to make sense of the world. I had a tremendous amount of respect for them as a kid. But when I first started doing comedy, I had it like, when you first start doing it, you got these five jokes. You got to fill like 4 minutes. And I don't think they're that bad. I saw a recent tape of me from 1987 on a local TV show in New Jersey, of all places. And I was much more polished than I thought I was. I hadn't seen it in years. I don't know where someone found it.
A memorized routine?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I was doing it, I had not done any television. I wasn't really doing that much club work at the time, but I just started. I was in L.A. being a doorman at the Comedy Store, doing sets for nobody in the small room upstairs there. But what I didn't realize is that how badly I wanted to do it.
Were you already talking about politics?
I didn't talk about politics too much. I talked about fairly provocative social issues, but not politics specifically, which I'm not that great at anyways.
Well, young comics talk about flop sweat.
Mm-hmm.
And you suggest that this has been a problem for you all along, that anxiety has...
I'm sweating now.
Are you scared?
No. I don't... Yes. Anxiety.
This is improv.
I'm with you. I'm saying yes all the way through, Leonard. We're going to do it. We're going to come up with some good riffs. Anxiety, as I get older, I realize was and is a continuing problem for me. But there's something about the immediacy of getting on stage where, everything else stops. It's very interesting. As scary as that is and as horrible as it could have been at different times on stage, which it has, you are in control. And it's all on you. And it's there's everything else stops.
But there's a big difference when you're starting and then later. Because when you're starting out, people don't know who Marc Maron is. You got to prove yourself. Later,
I still have to do that some places.
I would think audiences are attending to see you, and so they're already. All you have to do is make a face, and you're going to get a laugh.
Well, yeah, you give me a lot of credit, or my face, but well, that's true. And I, in all honesty, I think most of a comedian's job for as long as it takes him is to pretend like they're not afraid. I think that a lot of energy goes into that. And for me, I was not that great at it because I was relatively – the way I would do that is by being angry and provocative and shocking and defiant. Not everyone's idea of a night out. But ultimately, because of the podcast and because of people now coming to see me, I do feel like I'm in my own skin. I feel like I'm being true to myself, and I'm genuinely comfortable. I noticed this recently for the first time in my life. I'll look out on a stage. Sometimes I'll go to the theater before anyone comes in. I'll look at the stage, and I'll just be excited to get out there. I never had that. I'm like, that's what I do. It was never like I love show business in a way.
And then you get your laughs, and that's important too.
Well, connecting is important. You know, laughs, I don't get as off. Starting out, you want to get the laugh, and you want to get it where you want it to happen. I don't think about that as much anymore. I like things to happen immediately in the immediate moment. I like to be present. I like laughs to come, but I like to feel that connection where you can get laughs, you can get, you know, thoughtfulness, or you can get, you know, just reaction. I don't do a beat by beat thing anymore.
Didn't you audition for Saturday Night Live?
I did.
What happened?
Oh my God! I'm obsessed with it. Have you talked to that guy?
No.
You haven't talked to Lorne?
No.
Lorne.
Yeah, I think Lorne's been on our show.
I like that. I would never forget that. Leonard's like, maybe that guy was here.
Well, I wasn't auditioning for Saturday Night Live.
Well, no, I'm obsessed with what happened. It was very odd. I was seen somewhere by someone who worked there. Marcy Klein saw me doing comedy at an alternative comedy outlet. And she said, I want Lorne to see you. And then Lorne came to see me at the comic strip. And then I went to the studio and did a screen test. And then I had this meeting with Lorne that just, for me, stands out in my mind as this bizarre, you know, almost dreamlike experience that I guess didn't go well. Because I'm not on the show, but I am a little obsessed with him. And anybody I have on my show from SNL, I talk to about Lorne. Someday I will talk to Lorne.
Then you realize you developed a serious drug habit. Was that because you hadn't gotten the job?
No, I think I was always sort of compelled towards drugs as a young person. My idols were always, people like Keith Richards and William Burroughs and, you know, Bukowski and Pryor. Like, I gravitated towards that. And yeah, I got a little out of control. I was doing drugs then, but not. It did get a little gnarly with the coke and the booze.
You described times when drug dealers would kick you out, telling you you'd had enough.
You've had enough. Time to go.
That's like a bartender.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why I left L.A. that first time when I went out there. In the 80s, you know, I'd gotten pretty out there on coke. I'd gotten myself into a psychotic state from sleeplessness and cocaine use. And I was losing my mind. I was having a breakdown in the parking lot. And the drug dealer was there. And I said, yeah, I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. And he goes, well, you got to get out of here. you got to go do your own thing. And I'm like, when the drug dealer tells you to go, it's time to go.
So was that the event that got you to seek help?
The first time, sure. Yeah, I mean, I sought help after that. I went into treatment. I was about 22, I guess. And then I was, you know, I get a year and a half here or there for years. And it wasn't until 99 where it really sunk in. So, you know, I've got about 15 years, a little over 15 years now.
And you've talked to people over the years about they're having similar problems.
Yeah, it's a tricky problem. I talk to people about, yeah, I'm very open about recovery and I'm open about, you know, my addiction issues and what it's like to be an addict. I know that's not necessarily within the principles of the program of what I do, but I think it's important to know that it's possible.
My guest is Mark Maron. We're talking about a number of different things he's involved in, including WTF. How did the idea for WTF start?
Desperation.
You were at Air America at the time, weren't you?
Well, I was at Air America in its third manifestation. You know, I did the original morning show on Air America, and then I was fired by a guy who had a different vision for the network, the wrong vision. And then I was sort of put on a show by other people within the organization in Los Angeles, and then I got fired from that. But not fired because I did anything wrong. They just ran out of money. So years later, when I was in the middle of a divorce, there was a different crew in charge over there, and a guy called me up who I'd worked with before. He said, look, there's a new guy here. Why don't we do a video show? And I needed money bad because I was about to lose my house. So I said, look, if they'll pay her, I'll come do this. So we did that, and they ran out of money again, and then we were stuck in the studio.
What do you think went wrong with Air America? The idea seemed reasonable, but some people say it's because it didn't set an agenda the way conservative radio sets an agenda. It just seemed to be reacting to what Rush Limbaugh and others were saying.
I don't think that's true. I mean, if I were to ask you right now, what is the, across the board, what is the liberal agenda? Could you answer that question? I mean, I don't think that they're...
I don't think the Democrats who ran for office yesterday knew what the liberal agenda was.
Of course not. I mean, Democrats are not necessarily liberals. They're not progressive. So what you have is the thing about conservative talk radio is that they are all, give or take a few social issues, on the same page. There's a very narrow ideology there that plays to a lot of fury and a lot of fear and a lot of anger. You know, liberals are angry, but there's a very diverse chorus of voices. There's a lot of different approaches to progressivism. There's a lot of different liberal voices. So I don't think they were reacting to Rush at all. I think that everybody sort of, you know, did their own thing, and some of it was compelling and some of it was strident. Some of it was unlistenable, but ultimately it was an organizational problem.
And one of the broadcasters wound up in the Senate. Another one wound up at MSNBC.
Both of them great. There's no one better than Rachel. And I'm thrilled that Al is doing what he wants to do.
Did you know from the beginning that WTF would be different from a straightforward interview show? Or is that something that evolved over time?
I was never thought of myself as an interviewer. I think that, you know, it did evolve, but it was always me talking to people. But at the beginning, there was other elements. And then after I moved to L.A., there was a third act every once in a while. But once it became about me talking to someone one-on-one, I rarely prepare questions, which, you know, sometimes is tricky. I just have this desire to connect. And I think for the first year of WTF, it was really me needing to talk to people. I needed to talk to people.
So it was a conversation show.
Always.
And you were sneaking into the Air America studios
at the beginning
to record at the beginning?
Right. When I got fired that last time after we did the video show, they didn't, you know, we were still on contract. So they let us keep our office for a month. They let us keep our security card. So we just started breaking into the studio because we knew the night tech and trying this stuff out. You know, my partner, Brendan McDonald, who, you know, actually started here years ago, you know, who's been with me from the first time I was on radio. He's a genius. He's my producer. We just made a commitment to each other that we would figure out how to do this, and we'd do a show every Monday and every Thursday. We'd post it no matter what. We'll see what happens. Different to new show, and we've done that for over 5 years.
Does it matter that you now live in Los Angeles?
No.
Could you have done it in New York?
I don't know. I think it might have been more difficult to get the number of guests that I get and the accessibility to the people I talk to, comedians, directors, writers. I mean, they come through here, but it would have been tougher to schedule.
Why do you call your house the Cat Ranch? This is where you record the show
yeah,
now.
Yeah. I have a little house that was built in the 20s. It's a two-bedroom cabin almost. I have this old garage. I think it was built for a, you know, early model Ford. I call it the Cat Ranch because at the time I started WTF, I think there was four cats at the most that were mine. And then when there were several outside, and there was always cats around, and my cats were very important to me, and they still are. And that just became the nickname for it.
Was it easier to get your guests at the beginning to open up about their personal lives before the podcast became so popular?
Well, I don't know. Some people know what's up. Some people are being prepared now by handlers to expect what they're going to expect. I mean, look.
Prepared by handlers to come on the podcast?
Well, it's some, like now, it's weird. My garage and podcasts in general are now sort of a legitimate media stop. Now, I don't do junket interviews. I don't do promotional interviews. But sometimes that's when you get access to people, is when they're promoting something. I will do at least an hour of conversation with somebody, no matter what. But I think now that some publicists who handle larger celebrities are like, they're going to tell their clients what's going to happen. And I don't expect to get deep, dark secrets all the time. I just want the conversation to be connected. But John Favreau came in, and he is such a fan of my show that he was dictating what was going to happen next. He was like, all right, you're going to ask me about
my father.
He's
a director.
Yeah. You're going to tell me, you're going to ask me about my father. Just do it. Do it. Bring it. And I don't know. I don't think it has diminished what the show is. It got this reputation early on as being this deep, dark secret, people crying on it and all that kind of stuff. But I'll roll with whatever's given to me.
We'll take a little break and we'll come back and talk about depression as discussed on WTF and other issues. My guest is Mark Maron, who has now done WTF for how many years?
Over 5 years.
And with it's downloaded a million times a week, more than 140 million times over the years. He also is just about to go into production for the third season of his television show, Maron, which is broadcast on IFC. And we will continue our conversation, but first this. We're back with Mark Maron and talking about WTF and also his television show and stand-up comedy and whatever else we can get to. On WTF, people started talking about depression. Do a lot of comics have to deal with depression?
I don't know, proportionately different than any other occupation, you know, if you look at the percentages. But, yeah, sure, there's a lot of us that are overly sensitive, pained, depressed, angry? Sure.
And one of your early notable interviews was Robin Williams. Did you know him before you'd interviewed him or had the conversation with him?
Most of the interviews that you'll hear on WTF are first conversations, really. I mean, I know a lot of people, but it's not often that you have a one-on-one conversation with somebody for an hour in real life. I'm sorry that that's not the case, but it is the case. But with Robin, I had met him. He was a fan of mine. He was always very nice to me. But, you know, I didn't have his phone number or anything, but we knew of each other.
And the podcast starts up with your thoughts on the drive up to his home.
Yeah.
What were you expecting?
I don't know. It was a big deal for me. You know, one of the reasons, in all honesty, that I set out to really talk to Robin was because I got very tired of hearing younger comics condescend him. Like, you know, to say, like, to call him a hack or a thief or whatever. Because in my mind, it's like, this guy did it all. He did everything you wanted. He's still vital. He maintained a career. I mean, how could you dismiss him? So I was angry, and I was nervous to talk to him because I wanted to connect with him, and I wanted to show him the respect he deserved, and I also wanted to have fun. And I was in his home, so it was all very nerve-wracking.
But you've said you don't understand the non-angry-based comic, and Robin Williams wasn't an angry comic.
But he was certainly dark, wasn't he? I don't know that I don't think that it was necessarily anger. It just it comes from that profound sensitivity, that sort of existential discomfort. That I do believe I like comics that come from there. And a lot of them, no matter obviously how chipper they may seem, are have that in their heart.
You admitted on that show that you get angry with audiences. Yeah. How does that happen?
It doesn't happen as much as it used to, but sometimes, as we talked about before, you say that there are a lot of people that come out to see me. That's true, but you know, for most of my career, I was performing as an unknown headliner, and you've got to do your job. And in a lot of ways, there's still some management that has to be done. I was just doing the Comedy Works in Denver. It's a great club, and I was like, great, my audience is going to see me in this great room. And then on Saturday night, the staff comes in and says, there's a bachelorette party. There's 12 of them. And we're going to try to keep an eye on it. And I'm like, what? When do I not have to deal with that? Yeah. And right out of the gate, I just unloaded on this bachelorette party preemptively so they wouldn't ruin the show for people that come to see me. And after the show, the woman whose bachelorette party it was came up to me and said, they threw my mother out. And I'm like, well, hey, at least it was memorable. Did you have a good time? She said it was great.
Didn't Robin Williams discuss relapsing after 20 years being sober? So that was a connection, wasn't it?
It was all a connection. You know, Robin was a very sweet, open-hearted, big-hearted guy. He discussed, relapsing. He discussed addiction. He actually did an improvisation at the end of that podcast about suicide, which was profound and horribly prescient.
And we're going to play a clip from that.
Okay.
When I was drinking, there was only one time, even for a moment, where I thought, oh, life.
Right.
And I went like, then even my conscious brain went, did you honestly just say life? And went, you know, you have a pretty good life as it is right now. Have you noticed the two houses? Yes. Have you noticed the girlfriend? Yes. Have you noticed that, you know, things are pretty good even though you may not be working right now? Yes. Okay, let's put the suicide over here on discussable. Let's leave that over here in the discussion area. We'll talk about that. First of all, you don't have the to do it. I'm not going to say it out loud. I mean, have you thought about buying a gun? No. What were you going to do? Like cut your wrist with a water pick? Maybe. So that's erosion. What are you thinking about that? So can I put this over here in the what the f- category? Yes, let's put that over here in what the f- because.
So how did you react when you heard the news that he had committed suicide?
It's horrifying. It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable, even after having that conversation. To me, it was unbelievable that guy was not going to be on the planet anymore. For that reason, that guy. It was horrible. And you know, right away I was like, you know, because at that time that episode was behind the paywall on the app. And I was like, you know, I want people to know, you know, the full depth of his struggle. Like I was so excited to have that to give back for the grieving.
Two movies have come out since his death. Mm. He was working on them until he killed himself. And he had told you that working was a kind of a therapy.
Yeah.
But obviously it didn't work.
I don't know. You know, it's like it's so sad when people are struggling with that kind of depression. I don't have any experience of that. My father battles with depression, and it could have just been a bad morning. Who knows? It's just so tragic that it is really hard to treat that type of depression.
Another podcast where the issue of suicide was raised was the one with Todd Hansen.
Oh my God, that was crazy. That thing, I don't even know what to say about that. I have gotten emails from people who teach in medical school, if they can use that in their classes. Like, Todd Hansen's a brilliantly funny man. He was really the original editor of The Onion, and I'd known him for years. And I wanted to interview him. And I was out in Brooklyn. I was staying at a particular hotel, and I'd called Todd ahead of time. I said, "You want to do an interview? I'm going to be in Brooklyn." He said, "Okay." And he shows up at the hotel for the interview, says, "I've been here before." And I go, "Really? To this hotel?" He goes, "Yeah, but when I checked in, I wasn't going to check out." So this was coincidence. And then I said, "Are we going to talk about this?" He says, "I don't know, but I told my therapist that you were going to be the guy that was going to be here with me, thought it was a good idea." I had no idea. So we had that initial conversation, and he didn't talk about attempting suicide in that hotel. And I said, "Look, I'll sit on this. You decide whether or not it would be helpful for you to talk about this, because I think it would be helpful to a lot of other people." And a few months later, he said, "Okay, I'll talk about it." And I went to his house, and he walked me through the day that he attempted suicide. And he meant it in that hotel. And it was really it was one of the most profound experiences of my life, emotionally and otherwise.
And then you put the two together.
That's
into
right.
One show.
That's right. And I let him decide. I let him sit with the second part for a month to make sure he was comfortable with it. And I got thousands of emails from that show.
Do you give other guests Final Cut?
Yeah, always. I mean, I won't send it to them, but what happens generally is, like, I'm not out to sandbag anybody. And if somebody says something they're not comfortable with, I'll gladly take it out. Sometimes I'll argue with them, but it's always about something they said about somebody else. That's usually why people want things taken out.
Also because you talk a lot about your personal life. You talk about your childhood at times during these conversations. Where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in New Jersey. The first 6 years or so I did in New Jersey, and then I was in Alaska for a couple of years. Then I grew up primarily in New Mexico, Albuquerque.
Wow. So yeah. You were all over the place.
Yeah. My parents were of the first generation of American Jews that moved as far away from their parents as possible for reasons other than fleeing a country.
And did you feel that's one of the reasons kids act out sometimes, because they're new. They need a little attention. They don't want to feel like an outsider.
Well, I don't know if that was really the case.
Say that you also suggested that you faked hypochondria when you were a kid.
Well, I don't know if you fake hypochondria. Either you got it or you don't. And I think that in working through my past, which I do now fairly diligently, and I'm finding out more and more about myself to my chagrin sometimes, is that, you know, my parents were fundamentally selfish people and self-involved, and I felt a little emotionally abandoned. And my father was a doctor, so being hypochondriacal was the easiest way to get a doctor's attention.
My guest is Mark Maron. He continues to do his podcast, WTF, very popular, and he's about to embark on the third season of his IFC television show called Maron. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Not all of the WTF shows are downers. You touch on serious issues to comics, like joke stealing.
They're not downers.
Well, I mean, talk about depression and committing suicide. You interviewed Carlos Mencia, who is notorious. He's kind of like the Henny Youngman of contemporary comics when it comes to talking about joke stealing.
The Henny Youngman in an age where you can turn the world against him.
I have to tell you this. Henny Youngman was a guest on our show.
Yeah.
He was one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a different time. You know, and there was a time in comedy, especially on the East Coast with the Borscht Belt and everything else, where comics would be going on a show together and one would say to the other, "You're going to do that bit or am I?" I mean, it was a different time. And it was before, you know, stand-up was about point of view and specifically self-authorship. But no, with Carlos, there was a mistake made that when I first brought him on that show, it was because I knew that everybody in comedy hated him for being a joke thief. And I didn't know the extent of the thieving because I'm a little out of the loop sometimes. So I brought him on to ask him primarily what is it like to be the most hated person in comedy. I was trying to be empathetic. And I do this interview, and he just steamrolled me. And I played it for my buddy Al Madrigal, and he said, you can't release that. You didn't get anything out of him. And I'm like, I don't know what to do. I already told people that I'm going to release it. Well, you got to do another interview, and you got to, you know, call him on it. And I'm like, oh, God. So I called Mencia, and I say, look, we didn't get to what we need to get to. I need to talk to you again. He's like, all right, I just landed at LAX. I'll come now. And I was literally nervous about physically threat. I didn't know what was going to happen. And that second episode, you know, he didn't quite admit to stealing jokes, but he did come unhinged, and it was very telling.
And then you spoke to some of his former colleagues about his behavior.
Yeah, he was a little upset about that, and I'm not sure he was wrong to be upset about that. I talked to Steve Trevino, and I talked to Willie Barsena, who had known him and worked with him, you know, as sort of character witnesses. But Carlos didn't know I was going to do that. That might have been a little underhanded.
Did you approach IFC about doing the TV show Marin, or did they approach you?
Well, what I had was, you know, in television as a comic, you know, every few years you go in and pitch some version of your life to some executive somewhere. You take a general meeting and go, I'm doing this now and I could be this guy. And they go, okay, here's some money. Let's see if it'll happen. Or they don't. So basically what happened was, you know, I was a guy doing a podcast in my garage. And, you know, I went to Apostle. It's a production company, Jim Serpico and Dennis Leary's production company. They like the show. I have a lot of fans in the industry of the show. And he brought me in on a general meeting. Jim did. And he said, I love the show. What can we do with it? I said, well, I got an idea. How about a sitcom idea? It's a guy who interviews celebrities in his garage because nothing worked out for him. How's that sound? He's like, that sounds great. I'm good. I'm living it. So he took it. He had a deal with Fox Studios, and then they gave us some money to produce a pilot presentation, which we did. Like it could have been a pilot, and then we took that around, and IFC responded, and they got behind it, and they've been very good to work with.
There have been TV shows throughout the years based on people's personal lives. Dick Van Dyke Show was pretty much Carl Reiner, I guess. Then, of course, we had Raymond. More recently, Louis C.K. Is it a problem sometimes trying to find your own little niche?
Well, I mean, my life is very specific. You know, I'm a neurotic, you know, slightly irritable, single 50-year-old man, 51 now, who interviews celebrities in his garage. That world in and of itself is unique. And I have cats. So I wasn't so concerned about the world. But, you know, there's very few stories that haven't been told. And there's certain things that happen to you that, you know, may be fairly common. So that's the tricky thing. And also with Louis' presence being so, you know, looming large and him and I being friends, you know, I opted to do a show that was story driven. It's a three act structure and it's very uniquely my life. But we are aware. I don't want to get hackneyed, and I am the head writer by virtue of it's my show. So I'm fairly aware when I'm talking to my showrunners and my other writers whether something feels hacky or it doesn't.
In the pilot episode, your Marc Maron character is berated by a Twitter troll, a young man in his 20s. Is internet trolling a problem?
It's a horrible problem. But the bigger problem is responding to it.
I've stopped.
Good for you.
Because I was getting in trouble.
You were getting in trouble? But wasn't it hurting you?
Well, people say terrible things.
It hurts
sometimes.
You, right?
Yeah, and then I would respond.
You
and
can't
then,
win?
No.
There's no way, and then you get mean, and then you get in trouble.
Well, and then they complain to my boss that I was mean, even though they start off.
Now that is not fair play. I try not to.
That's reality.
I know, but you know, I try not to engage. But and a lot of times, I don't know what I'm looking for when I do engage. But it's almost sort of like, hey, come on, I think you're misunderstanding me. I for some reason want to get them on my team. But a lot of those internet trolls just do it because they get a kick out of it.
In the first episode of the second season, your girlfriend on the show is angry that your character jokes about her on TV and radio. And that has been an issue for the people involved with comics over the years.
Yes.
One even sued. Was Woody Allen sued by a former girlfriend or first wife?
Maybe. No, I think that is true. Yeah, he used to do a bit about that. Yeah, I don't remember who that first wife was. It wasn't. Yeah. That is an issue. Of course it's an issue, and you have to negotiate and be diplomatic and choose your battles. But ultimately, it can sink a relationship for sure.
Your character says in that episode, we say awful things about our parents and the people we love because we're comedians.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. And either they're going to take it or they're not. But they don't take it very well, generally. It's a rough decision to make. Some comics don't talk about reality at all, so they're kind of off the hook. But those of us who work from our heart and talk about our lives, yeah, I've gotten into a lot of trouble with a lot of exes and my parents with that. Not my mother so much, but certainly my father.
Memoirists have the same problem.
Yeah, I had that problem with my father with the memoir, too. We're okay now, but you know, I understand his point of view. But, you know, payback's a bitch.
You're starting production on season 3. Will you continue to produce the podcast while you're working on the TV show?
Absolutely. I try to get as many interviews as I can in the can. And then, during production, I'll do the opens and the close and the ads. And, yeah, we keep it going. We don't stop.
And then any other projects in the works? Are you still doing stand-up?
I do stand-up constantly. I've never done better stand-up. I'm here in New York tomorrow night. I'm doing the Skirball Center. We're doing 2 shows. I sold out 2 shows, which is a first for me. I'm very excited. Haven't played New York in a long time. It's exciting to be back.
Well, we can't plug it because you already sold out the shows.
I know, but I like saying it.
Mark Maron, thank you so much for being on our show again. It's always a pleasure talking with
you. Nice seeing you, Leonard. Thanks for having me.